Top Med Talk.
Hello and welcome to Top Med Talk. We are coming to you from our virtual studio for EBPOM Dingle 2020. I'm Desiree Chappell, your host, and joining me is our editor-in-chief, Monty Mithen. Hello, Monty, how are you?
Hey, Desiree, I'm okay. I'm a little bit blue for various different reasons that we'll come to in a second, but you know, you can't have great big picture, middle of COVID-19, I'm fine.
Yeah, right?
Stop whining.
Stop complaining. I know. Well, 2020 has brought many crazy, you know, just everything's been insane in 2020. Everything's been canceled or moved to virtual, and it's been no different for us in EBPOM. Monty, we've had two virtual conferences so far for EBPOM, haven't we?
We have. We did our EBPOM London, our iconic meeting, which we had many thousands of people join us from around the world. And then very recently, we had our EBPOM Chicago, and we're just about to have EBPOM Ireland from Dingle. But the sad thing is reality just kind of haven't really been more than a few hundred yards away from home.
I know, it's been rough. And, you know, EBPOM Ireland, or it's always been traditionally known as the Dingle Conference, right?
Yeah, absolutely. So Dingle, west coast of Ireland.
Yeah, I was going to say, for our listeners who may have not been to Ireland and not know Dingle, tell us a little bit more about that.
So if anyone saw the recent Star Wars movies, it's where they found Luke. Yeah. Those are the Skellig Islands off the west coast of Ireland. Some people believe it to be one of the most beautiful places in the world. You can debate that. Certainly on my list. It's where my mother's originally from, so it's a family place for us. And just over 20 years ago, we decided to have a meeting there. And it's I think it's become a sort of iconic meeting. I think,
absolutely,
as Professor Paul Miles said, one of the best little meetings of its kind in the world. Something along those lines.
But he's so true. I mean, it's a wonderful little boutique meeting. Just such high quality, like just dense amount of wonderful information and fabulous people from around the world. Monty, typically, you know, it is boutique. How many people do you typically have at what are your Dingle meetings?
It's a lively session. We'd have 100 to 200 people in the room. There's a couple more come to the black tie Kaylee dinner because partners arrive, etc. But it's a single in the room conversation is what we value. So it's, as I said, it's always extremely high quality content, speakers. And we, over the last few years, have live broadcast it. So I think we've been ahead of the game from the point of view of audio broadcasting it.
Absolutely.
But we'll be back. We'll be back.
We will absolutely be back. Well, you know, in true tradition of our EBPOM meetings, we always like to do a little Top Med Talk wrapped around that. And this year is no different. Our guest today is a recent addition to the Top Med Talk family. And after a fantastic conversation we had about gaming and education in medicine, we're excited to catch up with him again about a topic that we've talked a little bit on Top Med Talk about, but always looking to continue our conversation. We're going to be discussing cerebral oximetry and guidelines and the use of NIRS, which we'll explain just a little bit in just a moment. But we have Bob Teeley, who is an anesthesiologist, associate professor at the University of Virginia in Charlottesville. Bob, thanks so much for joining us again.
Thanks for having me. Appreciate it.
Yeah, it's good to see you. Well, it hasn't really been that long ago, about a month ago, that we had a really cool conversation about utilizing gaming in the education of providers in medicine, which was super cool. Did you learn anything new there?
Well, you know, a nice thing that came out of that is I was able to connect them with my residency program. So we're going to hopefully work together to actually implement some of that into our training. And I learned that one of my residents was a professional Halo gamer.
That's like a big deal.
Starting anesthesia. So he is going to be the best virtual intubator in the world.
We'll see how he does in the OR, but Milo, he can intubate somebody a mile away. That's awesome. Well, that is very, very cool. See, you never know what happens whenever we have this conversation, what can come out of him. 2020 has been a crazy year, but you've been really busy and you've had some recent publications. Can you tell us a little bit about those?
Yeah, so related to this, I've been doing cerebral oximetry research for probably 4 or 5 years, just interested in using it to better take care of people having cardiac anesthesia. So I have some sort of more translational scientific or engineering related publications in the last couple of years, and then recently published the Perioperative Quality Institute guidelines on the use of cerebral oximetry in the perioperative environment, which is part of their bigger effort to talk about brain health. So that was a conference that focused also on processed EEG and things like that. I was mostly focusing on the cerebral oximetry because that's my area of expertise.
Gotcha. Well, we'll talk about the guidelines here in just a little bit and do a deeper dive on that. But okay. I just want to make sure. So when we say NIRS, N-I-R-S, uh-huh. right? So what are we referring to there?
When we talk about NIRS, we're talking about trying to measure tissue saturation, which is different from pulse oximetry, which is really focused on arterial blood. So a pulse oximeter sort of shines infrared red light into tissue and looks at the pulsatile component of the absorbance to really focus on arterial blood. The object of NIRS is to look at actually typically brain, although there's some literature on like trauma and things like that where you can look at muscle tissue, but looking at the non-pulse, trying to measure the oxygen saturation, the level of tissue, which is non-pulsatile. So the number is going to be lower and you don't get the waveform that you see on the monitor.
Gotcha. Monty, you've done some work in this, haven't you?
Yeah, for over the decades, using it in different guises. And it's one of those very seductive technologies because it really, really ought to be the real deal. Let's cut through the reservations people have about it. I mean, it works. So if you take it into a controlled laboratory environment with adult humans and you do stuff to them like make them hypoxic, which we've done, it does all the right things. I mean, it's, let's park the objections about the base technology for a second. I'm sure Bob will talk about some refinements to it. But as it said, you can also put it in different parts of the body. So people have played with thinner evidence, near infrared spectroscopy as being a sort of surrogate measure for the rest of the body oxygenation. People have put it on different muscle beds. People have tried to put it over kidneys. But the brain has been the main place where measurements have been made over the decades.
Yeah. And is that, again, for our listeners, a standard practice, Bob, to use cerebral oximetry in cardiac surgery or in any surgery for that matter?
Yeah, no, I would not say that it is, I wouldn't call it standard. I mean, there's definitely a lot of variation in institutions for sure. And probably in countries I only practice in the United States. And so I don't have a lot of, I have no experience providing anesthesia in the UK or continental Europe, but I don't think it's reached the level of standard of care for where compared to like the pulse oximeter or something like that.
Mm-hmm. But been highly recommended to use in cardiac surgery specifically.
Well, it depends. Our guidelines, we can get into the weeds on this a little bit. Like a lot of the people that wrote these guidelines for cardiac anesthesiologists who have a strong interest in NIRS, and we all believe, as Monty said, it works. And in particular, there's a whole litany of case reports of sort of catastrophic intraoperative events that were detected with cerebral oximetry. But then when you talk about sort of guidelines in recommending it in the United States, we do 500,000 CABGs a year and maybe half that for valves. So that sort of level of practice change, you do have to look at outcome data more closely. And it's not been as well studied as some of the other interventions we have. And so that was kind of the tension in our group. And it's not something we could really resolve without more solid data. Yeah. Does that make sense?
Absolutely. I mean, the big picture, Desiree, at the end of the day, is because it's not a standard of care. In other words, it's not like pulse oximetry has crept in or end-tidal CO2 has crept in, which also do not have a fundamental evidence base that demonstrates improved outcomes. We've done the mm-hmm. biggest trial ever of pulse oximetry, and we proved that it didn't make a difference.
Right.
But they became a standard of care because they're intuitively good things to do. So, some practices, they use cerebral near-infrared spectroscopy the whole time, and some practices, they never use it, and some practices, they use it selectively. That tells you that we don't really have the slam dunk, big randomized controlled trial, as we don't for pulse oximetry or end-tidal CO2 and everything else. But it works. It does the job it's designed to do, if you say.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, Bob, take us a little bit into, you know, into this discussion that you guys had around developing those guidelines. Because, well, and first of all, I guess we should back it up just a little bit. Monty, you were helped form Pokey, one of the founding members. Tell us a little bit more about that organization.
So perioperative quality initiative, standard sort of not-for-profit collaborative, whereby people get together and using an iterative adapted Delphi type of process. You know, let's bring the evidence we believe stands up to answer questions to the table. Let's get together, which increasingly is going to be virtual, it would appear. Let's debate what we think the literature tells us, and then let's produce some recommendations, accepting the fact, and we do grade and all that sort of thing, that sometimes you just have to make a best evidence-based pragmatic recommendation. Because people at the end of the day just want a bit of help to say, you know, should I use this in all my blah patients? So it's that complicated mix of pure evidence-based and sometimes recommendations that are built on, you know, consensus statement.
Yeah. So Bob, take us into that, because I mean, it sounds like, you know, what you guys, the task that you guys had with cerebral oximetry, because there's not as much literature out there, probably was interesting, to say the least.
Yeah. So, well, to back it up and just circle back with brain health, I mean, what we all know now is that the risk of developing we have pretty good data on the stroke risk for non-cardiac surgery and cardiac surgery. And what we found more recently is there have been a bunch of trials looking at what's called occult stroke or a covert stroke. So tissue death on MRI, brain MRI that you see after surgery, and in cardiac surgery, it's quite high. It's about probably over 1,000 people have had MRIs and TAVRs, AVRs, cavities, and the pooled incidence is about 36 to 39%. And if you look at people, this has been better studied really in, the sort of the cerebral desaturation and non-cardiac surgery, the neurovision trial. Now there's going to be a cardiac neurovision trial. But if you, the people that, even if you don't have a clinical stroke, so, you know, weakness or like an immediate neurological deficit, those people that have occult strokes are more likely to develop POCD and have long-term dysfunction and higher mortality. So we realized that the problem of protecting the brain is probably bigger than we realized, than we knew in 2006 when cerebral oximetry became more widespread. So that's the problem that everybody's trying to solve. And it's why the focus of NEAR's technology is always on the brain. And so, you know, the first question is, does it do, you know, like, how does it work? And does it do what we think it does? And the answer is it does work. It does do what we think. And a great example of, you know, sort of what I would consider a novel but frequent use of it is a lot of times in cardiac anesthesia, you don't have a really good pulse oximetry signal because of all the vasopressors and the temperature changes and the bypass, or they got an LVAD and so they have no pulsatility. And in that scenario, there's no way, the pulse oximetry doesn't work at all. And so there's no way to measure continuously arterial oxygen saturation. But if you put NEARs on, you can measure their cerebral saturation, and it's continuous because it doesn't require a pulse. And so that's a great surrogate actually for even pulse oximetry in some cardiac surgery populations. So understanding how it works is quite important. And a lot of the focus of our discussion was teasing out the things that people need to understand so that they're not just flying blind and using this monitor and not really understanding it. Once you get to that, past that point, then you can sort of make decisions about how it's actually useful. And we, as I mentioned previously, we all agree that there are these sort of, everybody's got experiences having used it and seen something bad happen and then watching those numbers drop either on one side or bilaterally, depending on what the problem is. That's, I would say, universal in people who do cardiac anesthesia. The stickier part is, you know, the data and recommending it, at least for the U.S., to be used in almost 1 million people a year. And that gets harder. The evidence bar has to be a little bit higher. And it, you know, I love the pulse ox example because pulse oximetry has been tested quite well and shown to not improve outcomes. And we use it. It's an ASA standard monitor, and nobody would ever do an anesthetic without it. Certainly, I wouldn't. So that, you know, maybe if you trained in the 1940s and you're used to not having it.
Easy, Bob. Easy.
Nobody. I started pre pulse ox.
Yeah, it was so, just that was just the 80s, though, wasn't it?
I look great to these 40s.
But that was just in the 80s, wasn't it?
Yeah, it's not that long ago, and it was very, very highly debated. You know, we basically, our minimal monitoring was intermittent blood pressure measurement, and there was an EKG that you moved around the various different operating rooms. So the minimal monitoring standards were quite a revelation, and they're actually relatively recent. So we accepted the first bundle that we took over as being minimal monitoring, and then started to introduce bar heights for evidence after that, forgetting the fact that historically none of the other stuff is actually proven to the level we're demanding of the new stuff. Sorry, Bob. That's just the reality of it.
And I think it's perfectly defensible for pulse oximetry to be a standard, even with the negative data, for several reasons. One, it's very inexpensive. Two, it causes no harm. And three, there are some other arguments. People like me never trained to do anesthesia without it. Yep. And you can argue that as patients have gotten more complex and the operating the procedures are more complex, it frees up cognitive bandwidth. I mean, maybe I could do an anesthetic without it, but I would spend so much time trying to avoid desaturation. I would not spend my time with temperature regulation or monitoring the depth of anesthesia and other things that also are important.
So, I think, Bob, if you look at that first big trial, the Scandinavian trial, where they tried to determine if it made a difference, the two positive findings was more oxygen was used, and everyone felt who's caring for the patient felt better, because it was very, very, very stressful wondering if a tube had disconnected under the drapes. Yeah. And there were people, you know, having the drapes taken away at the end of it, and they had disconnected tubes, and they had, you know, serious brain damage back in the day. So it's a huge advance. You'll probably never prove that sort of thing in a trial because the event rate's so low.
Right. Yeah. Now, and to bring it back to cerebral oximetry.
Yeah.
That level of study hasn't been done. So we have what I would describe as complete clinical equipoise. We don't have data to say, you know, large scale data to say that it is helpful, that it clearly improves sort of neurologic outcomes, but we also don't have data to say on a large scale that it doesn't. That was the struggle for us.
Yeah. What are some of the common misconceptions of, you know, why would somebody not use this then?
My own feeling, I think it falls into two buckets. One, there's a medical legal part. So in the U.S., that's a pretty powerful driver for behavior, I would say, in physician world generally. And if you are placing a monitor on and the data is not favorable and you have a bad outcome, then you could be criticized for, you didn't do anything about that. And even if you were watching and you thought about it and you did make an intervention and it didn't change, that it's perceived as a liability. Mm-hmm. I've heard that from multiple people. The other simply is just expense. It is certainly not as, it is more expensive than pulse oximetry. The patches cost more, and then there's a separate device that doesn't, you know, every anesthesia monitoring system has inputs for pulse oximetry, and that's not the case with cerebral oximetry. And then I would also argue there's like a human factors convenience component, which is because it's not standard yet and built in, you've got another thing that has to sit in the operating room and people are looking at it. It's another device to plug in. It doesn't feed into the EMR. So there's some little things like that actually can add up to make a pretty big difference.
Yeah.
And I think if I may, Bob, not everyone is necessarily as engaged in the physiology of cerebral oxygen delivery consumption, the balance between the two, and the number going up is not always a good thing, and all of that stuff, the same as with mixed venous saturation, etc. So some people say, well, you know, the number was great, but they still woke up with a stroke. You see, yeah, but it was embolic, you know, it's a little bit of the brain it's gone to. It can't do that.
You know? Right. Yeah, but, you know, That's absolutely true. And you see that like in the ICU with sepsis all the time, a high SVO2 is not necessarily make you feel good about your patient. But it is also true that it's clear that on a population level, the people who have the desaturations intraoperatively are at much higher risk for cognitive stroke and cognitive dysfunction afterwards.
So tell us about what did the guidelines find? What did you guys end up suggesting?
Yeah, you know, we said that if you're going to use it, you've got to use it. You have to put it into context. So you need to know what someone's baseline value is. And that's a really important point because everybody's individuals have quite different variables, which is mm-hmm. maybe not intuitive. If you don't understand how it works, you think, oh, a normal pulse ox is like 94 to 99 in everybody. And that's not the case with cerebral oximetry because of the way that it works. And so people have to understand that the baseline, you really do have to compare it to the baseline. And then all the devices are different. So you can't really compare a value with one manufacturer to a value of another manufacturer, which is another sort of complicating factor, I would say, in terms of use, because you might read a paper that uses the InVos device, which is what most of the papers are. But if your hospital is using some other manufacturer, then you think, well, you have to think for a second about how you're going to interpret that.
It can really determine, you know, the rest of your case if you don't get an accurate baseline. And I've used it a lot in practice because it was a standard for us in our practice for cardiac patients. So I've used it for, you know, 10 years. But I think, you know, for a lot of people, they may not understand exactly how to use it.
And did you do baselines on everybody?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And that's our practice at UVA.
Can you explain to everyone what you mean by getting a baseline? Is that pre-induction of anesthesia you put your monitor on, or?
Yeah, we will actually put it on in the operating room before we do any pre-oxygenation and leave it there for several minutes. And then we use the InVos device, and then we set baselines, and it creates a dotted line, this easy reference for the rest of the case to kind of see where they are in comparison to where they started. Because as soon as they go to sleep and they're intubated with 100% oxygen, it goes way up. You get a little buffer.
Yeah.
And then it's what happens on bypass and afterwards that matters. Yeah.
Exactly. And you're like, well, that's not too, you know, that wouldn't be too bad. But that's a fair point. So any other big highlights from it?
Yeah, I mean, we felt like it was a pretty powerful sort of risk predictor for people who are interested in that. I mean, the data on that's very compelling. If you show up to the operating room and you have a really low resting cerebral oximetry value, that's not a good sign for you. I mean, we don't, you know, tell people that when they're going off to sleep, but in terms of thinking about like what's going to be like it during the case and in the ICU, that could potentially be helpful. And then, you know, we did recommend that it should be used to guide management of cerebral malperfusion during cardiac surgery, just because we all understand that it can detect some of these catastrophic events. Mm. And that was kind of the way that we wanted to word it, because we can't tie that back to necessarily strokes as an outcome, but we've all seen that. I think at the end of the paper, we really kind of harped on that we ultimately, like, this is a sort of institutional decision that everybody's going to make. And that really is a cost benefit calculation that different healthcare systems in different countries have to make. That's where we left it. I'm hoping that in, you know, 4 years from now, as we go through the POCI cycle, we'll start to see more data, like the cardiac neurovision data will be out. Right now, they've only done a pilot study. They did 50 patients just to power a future study. And the original neurovision was over 1,000 patients. So that could be a pretty powerful piece of data that might change some of our recommendations in a few years.
Yeah. Monty, did you want to comment?
Yeah, just the other thing we have to remind ourselves about, because we'll be doing quite a lot about autoregulation, including cerebral autoregulation and other organ autoregulations, is one of the challenges with cerebral NIRS, you know, the brain being, you know, flow dependent on a pressure head above a particular threshold, is you can make cerebral NIRS look great while you're killing the gut and killing the kidneys and, you know, sorry, that's harsh words, but you know what I mean? If you're very cerebrocentric, you've got to remember there are other organs that take their blood supply and oxygen delivery in different ways. And that's possibly why it hasn't necessarily delivered the slam dunk change, because sometimes people, you know, cause collateral harm by trying to make this bit look good. You've got to keep it all happy.
And I would also add to that on the autoregulation concept, you know, there is a lot of really interesting work that Chuck Ho started at Johns Hopkins. Now he's at Northwestern, really looking at sort of this NIRS autoregulation curve. Can you see where someone's breakpoint is, where their brain no longer can autoregulate based on plotting out the map and the cerebral SAT values over time? Now, that's cumbersome to do that as an individual in a case, but the end goal is to really work that out so that it's automated, and then you can see where they are. And that would be, that's a very high potential innovation that's, I think, coming down the pike.
And Dr. Chuck Hoag is very kindly pre-recorded a lecture for us that we played in Chicago. We'll be playing again at Dingle, and we'll be having a round table panel discussion about that very point. So thanks for that. Thanks for that plug, Bob.
That plug, Bob.
which you didn't know about, but well, no. Great.
Yeah, no, I didn't.
Bob, did you guys in your discussions, I guess, touch upon the idea that, you know, just because your brain's okay, that you may have other issues going on? Or was that even, you know, it was probably on down the road that discussion happened?
We did not. We really were focused on sort of brain protection, because that was the goal of the conference, and that's what that's really what Cerebral NEARS was, or NEARS as we used it now, is developed for. But it's a really, really good point. I mean, if you use drugs and blood pressure purely focused on the brain, you know, high doses of alpha agonists and vasopressin typically will shunt blood flow to the brain at the expense of other organs. And so that's something that, you know, when these trials are, as increasingly sophisticated studies are done looking at NEARS, they're going to have to, well, everybody's going to want to know, does this thing really help me prevent stroke or occult stroke and POCD in the future? Is that coming at the expense of GI dysfunction or something, or AKI or something like that?
Yeah, it was really interesting, because the more involved I got into this, and whenever I would go back to practice to think about, wow, if I'm already starting to see issues cerebrally, then obviously there's some other things going on, you know, to consider. So, well, Bob, one thing that I want to touch on before we end today is, you know, you talked about brain health and utilizing this in cardiac surgery. What about other types of procedures and care settings?
So I think, you know, non-cardiac surgery is interesting. And we don't really think about stroke as being as much of an issue in non-cardiac surgery. And certainly clinical stroke is less common in non-cardiac surgery than adult cardiac surgery. And occult stroke or covert stroke, so MRI lesions, are also less common. But they actually occur more than we realize, maybe as high as 10% in non-cardiac surgery, occult, you know, MRI-identified lesions. And so that does suggest that there may be an opportunity to improve care in that patient population. Well, certainly there's a lot more non-cardiac surgery in the world than cardiac surgery. We haven't really studied that very well. But the other thing I would argue is that in the post-operative environment, we don't know a lot about this, but I know that when I was in my fellowship, this was being studied at Duke, and I don't think they published this, but they were seeing a fair number of cerebral desaturations in the ICU in the first 24 hours after cardiac surgery. And so that, you know, everybody kind of feels like all these insults are happening in the OR, but they're probably not all happening in the OR. And so that makes that, I also work in the ICU, and you know, all this, you don't just bring everybody up and then you extubate them and they're not moving their hand. Like, that does sometimes happen, but a lot of times that sort of stroke event seems to occur 2 days after surgery or 3 days, which, brings up an important question. If we're going to use it, why, you know, as soon as they come up to the ICU, the nurses are like ripping off the
everything,
this monitor, and taking off the Invo strips and get, yeah, exactly. They want them clean. And we don't actually have, all of our, at UVA, all of our boxes live in the OR with a couple extra, we have a couple extra monitors that we really use for our ECMO patients. And that's a great example of actually a patient population where we use non-cerebral oximetry. We will put these on the lower extremities of people who have distal perfusion cannulas who are on ECMO in the ICU, and use it frequently for that. But we aren't set up to have cerebral oximetry postoperatively, you know, on like 8 patients at the same time. That's something that somebody should look at, because we know that the strokes don't all occur in the OR.
It's probably like many of those things, which is what we found with our peripheral near-infrared spectroscopy study in cardiac patients. It was a small pilot. It's all been published, but it's about 6 hours that you got, if there was a signal there, you got it at about hour 6, which we kind of know you're either extubated and fixed and doing fine, or you're not quite right. If you're not quite right, that's when the mischief is starting to happen. And that's when, you know, it's possibly 2 o'clock in the morning, blah, blah, blah. You know, so.
Yeah. Yeah, fair point. You know, one of the things, just because I think it was pretty useful for me just in the OR was for shoulder cases, you know, sitting cases and in carotids, we used them on those as well. I mean, I think we were pretty progressive actually for being a community hospital in Louisville, Kentucky for utilizing this stuff. But I think for shoulders, one thing it was when I started using it, you know, the idea of, oh, well, we'll keep them normotensive or whatever they want, you know, or the surgeon says, you know, can you keep them a little hypotensive for me so I don't have bleeding? And then you look at your brain stats, you're like, no, I can't actually, you know, like not going to work for us here. It was a good application there.
Yeah, no, there are definitely a lot of reports of that and actual studies showing the sort of effects of shoulder upright positioning on cerebral saturation for sure. And that is a rare but catastrophic event. You know, I mean, think about if you were having that surgery, would you want it? Yeah, you probably would.
I think that what we're trying to, we're overdue discovering is what is the lower limit of acceptable blood pressure with regards to maintaining adequate cerebral oxygenation. And because you say it's such a rare event, but it should be a never event, shouldn't it?
Never.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely.
And we don't know it's going to be the answer, but it's intuitive and it needs looking at, you know.
Yeah. Well, Bob, in closing, you know, a couple things. How do we, I mean, it seems like, again, you have, don't you have a tech background or engineering background?
I have my undergraduate degree was in chemical engineering. They didn't have biomedical when I was in college, so I've sort of morphed a little bit, but yes, my background is in engineering.
But it sounds like you're, you know, and when we talked to you before, you know, tech and gear and monitors and things like that. So how do we inspire people to utilize and fully integrate, you know, monitoring technology like NIRS, like, you know, whatever it is that we're talking about into practice?
You know, I think, I would love it if everybody was a nerd and it would make me feel better about myself.
That's you wouldn't be if everyone was a nerd, then you wouldn't be a nerd.
And you wouldn't be cool. Come on now.
But we're never going to make the entire world passionate about technology and monitoring, but what we can do is, you know, teach people about the problems that we're trying to solve. And that's what the whole brain health and smart tots, all those movements to kind of really, you know, create awareness about some of the downstream effects of anesthesia and surgery and just sickness in general, I think is the key, because if people really understand that a certain percentage of their patients are going to have a stroke or brain death or some sort of tissue ischemia, they'll become increasingly interested in figuring out how to prevent that. But I have mixed feelings about it, you know, because I don't want to like scare the public. Cause that comes up now, right? Like the whole idea of PhD is all over the lay press. And, you know, sometimes I feel like people are, it can be, in some ways harmful if people are really scared to have surgery that they need because of POCD, is if they don't have the surgery, they're going to be much worse off. So it's good in that it encourages us to sort of try to solve these problems, both in the OR today perspective, but also researchers. But it can be a little bit scary when the whole world thinks that they're going to be, you know, not remembering their phone number. That's not a good example. Nobody knows phone numbers anymore. They're, they can't remember their Twitter handle because they had, you know, non-cardiac surgery.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, Bob, congratulations on all the work that you've been doing. Great job on that. If people want to find the article, the new POCI guidelines, where are those coming out on?
It's in Anesthesia and Analgesia. Yeah. So it's been published.
Okay. Great.
And most of them are accessible on POQI.org.
That's right. Yeah, plug for that. Fantastic. Well, again, thank you so much for joining us. It's always a pleasure to talk to you, Bob. Hopefully we'll have some more conversations coming up. And hopefully one of our next ones will at least be in person.
Yeah, we need to get you to Dingle, Bob.
Yes, absolutely. That is on the list for 2021. Well, thank you so much for viewing and listening, however you're consuming Top Med Talk today. Please check out the show notes. We can put we'll put the link to the article in the show notes on the podcast for you. So no worries there. And, so if you didn't know about Dingle before this Top Med Talk, you know, there may be somebody out there who may not have heard of at Pump Ireland and Dingle, please, please, please make sure you put it on your bucket list, because it really is one of the most wonderful places on the earth. And if you are longing desperately to be in Dingle this weekend or this week, I know as Monty and I definitely are, and the whole team from EPOM, Solange. So, cheers.
And absolutely.
And Solange, did I say it wrong?
No, that'll work.
Solange.
You tried. It's good to try.
That's an effort. I was like so gearing up for that, Monty.
Louisville.
Stop it. Thank you, Bob. That was great.
TopMed Talk. Thanks for downloading TopMed Talk. Don't forget to subscribe via your podcatcher. Don't forget to check us out on social media. We're on Twitter, Facebook, LinkedIn, and YouTube. And also, don't forget, TopMed Talk is the broadcasting arm of EPOM, evidence-based perioperative medicine. We'd love you to find out more about that. If you check out EPOM.org, you can find low prices on some of the conferences we're organizing around the world. Many of them are virtual and don't even involve you leaving your own home. Check out EPOM.org now.